to all of you who are making a difference in our communities as we come back to fill the seats we have long belonged in. Madeline Alakirella wunga inu khatikai inu khatikitsia hatata. Ukhausivut pikhusivullu anneriluit. Piguna vili matini. Atsunai!
Words and Culture is made possible with funding from SiriusXM through the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Words and Culture is produced by Kim Wheeler. Kaylin Belair is our audio engineer and editor.
Onigiwahi.
Gigawabamin. Soko Seni Denit E. Nina Nuji Hina.
Eko Se.
Kakuhut Dao. We'll see you again.
If you don't identify yourself as a homosexual person, the religious right will use you by just simply turning their head. But once you're out, you're out. After communism fell, what would be the issue that would call the co-belligerents together? They're now meeting around the issue of abortion and homosexuality. They're not just using lesbian and gay, anti-gay rhetoric to raise money and mobilize volunteers. They really believe we should be killed.
This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Australian queers demand to be seen in upcoming census, more woke U.S. companies put to sleep by right-wing media troll, and prophetic Mel White's perspective on religion and politics. Those stories and more this week because you've chosen This Way Out.
I'm Michael LeBeau.
And I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending August 31st, 2024. Facing a firestorm of criticism from queer groups and progressive politicians, the Australian Bureau of Statistics 2026 census will consider including one question about sexuality. The Labour Party had explicitly promised to survey LGBTQ plus Australians in the census during their 2023 election campaign. However, Assistant Treasury Minister Andrew Leigh announced on August 25th that no question about sexuality or gender would be added. Deputy Prime Minister Richard Marles excused the decision, saying, "We do not want to open up divisive debates in the community." The omission announcement and rationale sparked outrage, and a new question is now being drafted. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese explained the process in an August 30th interview on ABC Radio Melbourne.
As long as the testing goes okay and a question can be developed in a way that is sensitive and that gets the information that is required, and the ABS will be testing that. There's a draft question has been developed this week, which they will go and test.
The Trans Justice Project was one of the organizations that pressured the government. CEO Jackie Turner argued, "What the government is saying by excluding us from the census is that our communities, our families, and our friends don't count. The trans community needs this data to tell us just how big our community is, where we are living, and to determine what our health and service needs actually are." Equality Australia Chief Executive Anna Brown applauded the government's limited response, but it's only the beginning. She said in no uncertain terms, "The federal government shouldn't pick and choose those of us who are worthy of being counted. Until questions on gender identity and intersex people are included, the census won't include all Australians."
The U.S. Census Bureau is also developing better ways to include sexual orientation and gender identity. Following a public comment period, the White House Office of Management and Budget approved new test questions in mid-July for its monthly American Community Survey. The current series of survey questions began in August and will continue through the end of the year. Results are expected in early 2026. It's used to evaluate household information and determine how federal funds should be spent. A 2022 survey counted 1.3 million households headed by same-gender couples. About 741,000 were legally married. That's 57%. The survey also found that about 31% of all queer couples were interracial, more than their heterosexual counterparts. There are significant limitations to the survey, as noted by Whitman Walker Institute and the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights. They pointed out in an August 29th blog post that by only identifying queer couple-led households, the survey ignores 5 in 6 LGBTQ U.S. adults who are not living in coupled relationships.
A right-wing zealot's campaign to stamp out the diversity, equity, and inclusion programs of U.S. corporations claimed 4 more victories this week. Whiskey maker Jack Daniels, home improvement and supply retailer Lowe's, motorcycle maker Harley Davidson, and the Ford Motor Company are now abandoning their queer commitments. They joined tractor supply company and home and farm equipment maker John Deere, all surrendering DEI efforts in their workplaces and public demonstrations. The one-man anti-woke band is far-right political internet troll Robbie Starbuck. A self-styled giant corporation slayer, Starbuck crowed to his social media followers, "We are winning, and one by one we will bring sanity back to corporate America." Starbuck is a conspiracy theorist who's claimed, among other things, that tap water is turning kids queer. Virtually all of Starbuck's hit lists are high scores in the Human Rights Campaign's Corporate Equality Index. President Kelly Robinson called Starbuck a MAGA bully. She points out that his only business experience is hawking vitamins marketed by people profiting off of COVID disinformation. Still, Starbuck can attest, "We are now forcing multi-billion dollar organizations to change their policies without even posting, just from fear they have of being the next company that we expose." This may bring an unexpected end to the clashes regarding the over-corporatization of Pride events.
On the other end of the corporate spectrum, Aetna will be the first U.S. insurance company to extend fertility treatment coverage to LGBTQ people. A lawsuit had challenged disparities in the company's coverage of intrauterine insemination between heterosexual and queer policyholders. The settlement agreement helped prompt the change in policy announced this week. Writer Emma Goidell was the lead plaintiff in the lawsuit, along with her partner, Ilana Kaplan. The couple was forced to pay $45,000 through the student health plan for Columbia University before Aetna agreed to cover the procedure. Aetna's chief medical officer, Dr. Kathy Moffitt, called the new policy yet another demonstration of Aetna's commitment to women's health across all communities, including LGBTQ+ and unpartnered people. Goidell's press release said, "We hope other insurance companies will follow Aetna's example and review their policies to make sure everyone has equal access to fertility care."
The privacy rights of New Hampshire's transgender public school students got the backing of the state Supreme Court this week. Manchester School District policy requires staff to address all students by their requested names and pronouns. Such personal information cannot be shared with a parent or legal guardian without the student's permission. The mother of a child in the district claimed that the policy infringed on her parental rights, but the August 30th ruling rejected her complaint. Justices found that the district's rule placed no limits on the plaintiff's ability to parent her child as she sees fit. LGBTQ legal advocates and defenders and the ACLU of New Hampshire defended the district's policy with the support of a local mom and her trans high school son. The attorneys said in a joint statement, "We are pleased with the court's decision to affirm what we already know, that students deserve to be treated with dignity and respect and have a right to freely express who they are without the fear of being forcibly outed."
Finally, the Austin, Texas Brewtorium Brewery and Kitchen has cooked up an appropriate response to Dow's violent threats. Their June 9th Pride Month drag event was stopped in mid-show by a bomb threat. A police search of the premises found nothing suspicious, but it forced the venue to close for the rest of the day. Not to be drowned out, management announced the launch of a new tropical-flavored brew on August 23rd. It's fruited to the max with grapefruit, mango, pink guava, and orange. A portion of its sales will go to Veterans for Equality, a group of military vets who provide protective services for events hosted by marginalized communities like the Brutorium's Shuttered Drag Brunch. In announcing the birth of the fruity new brew, blatantly named Big Gay Beer, Brutorium proclaimed, "Our continued commitment to being a safe place for queer people and all good, kind, and loving individuals in our city."
That's News Wrap, Global Queer News with Attitude for the week ending August 31st, 2024. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Greg Gordon and Lucia Chappell, produced by Brian DeShazer, and brought to you by you.
Thank you. Help keep us in ears around the world at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast and much more. For This Way Out, I'm Michael LeBeau. Stay healthy.
And I'm Tanya Kane Perry. Stay safe.
Our listeners support This Way Out in many ways.
By subscribing to our e-newsletter.
Email us at info@thiswayout.org.
And through your financial contributions to our program.
More information about how you can give is online at thiswayout.org.
Thank you.
Everybody who loves God and struggles with being queer, just know you're not alone. In God, there's no fear. No matter what they say, look, God, he's still here.
We celebrate you because you're truly amazing. So who are they to judge? Kings and queens, true supreme.
White Christian nationalism didn't come out of nowhere. The seeds of this dangerous anti-democratic ideology that has a stranglehold on today's Republican politics can clearly be seen in this 30-year-old interview. Mel White is a gay Christian activist author who started out as the closeted Christian ghostwriter for some of the most powerful conservative Christian proselytizers in the U.S. He came out in 1994 with the book Stranger at the Gate, To Be Gay and Christian in America. Even then, he was realizing the trend toward politicizing evangelical thought.
The religious right has a political agenda, and it is, without exception, more than conservative now. It's a fundamentalist agenda. We say orthodoxy gone cultic. Fundamentalism is orthodoxy gone cultic. When you begin to see enemies under every bush, when you begin to feel prophetic and knowing exactly what God's will is for the nation, when you forget pluralism and when you forget democracy and want theocracy. So you begin to see the political agenda, and then you start realizing that the religious agenda is not only secondary, it's way down the line. Right now it's a power agenda, and that's what makes them frightening. They're true believers. This is not Machiavellian. They're not just using lesbian and gay, anti-gay rhetoric to raise money and mobilize volunteers. They really believe we should be killed. The Leviticus 20 passage says a man who sleeps with another man is an abomination of worthy of death. And on a talk show in Seattle just 4 or 5 days ago, they had a minister of a large fundamentalist church. And I said, "Do you really believe we should be killed?" He said, "Well, it isn't easy to say, but that's what God's will is for you." And I said, "Well, then who should do that? The churches?" And he said, "No, the civil authorities." "Oh," I said, "then how do they do it?" He said, "Well, that's why we're working so hard politically now, so that we can finally get men into power who will do God's will and will take God's orders seriously." And I said, "Seattle, are you listening? Just beneath this patina of civility, they want us dead."
Jerry Falwell galvanized evangelicals in 1979 for an anti-LGBTQ campaign associated with Anita Bryant as the Moral Majority. Falwell's organization was later overshadowed by the Christian Coalition, led by Christian Broadcasting Network founder Pat Robertson. Robertson actually ran for president in 1988, solidifying his role in religious right politics. Mel White and KPFK's Ian Masters discussed the impact of those organizations then and the implications for the future.
The size of the Christian Coalition is just approaching 1 million members now, and their dues are really heavy, and they are at work assigned to 50,000 American precincts. There's at least 12 in every precinct, and their goal is, one of their primary goals is to create, initiate legislation that will keep lesbian and gays from all rights, and yet, you see, that's just the facade. To say we have no rights, the next critical mass will be to say isolation, detention, and death.
Being straight myself, and I never wake up and say I'm straight, and I'm sure you don't wake up and say I'm gay. I mean, it's a sort of unnecessary dichotomy, really. But what I most fear is that the attacks on gays and lesbians is merely the unfurling of the fig leaf. I mean, they want to go after anybody who doesn't agree with them. I mean, straights have as much to fear as gays. You just happen to be the first and most visible. But look what happened when you have a theocracy. I mean, this is what I can't understand, why there isn't a kind of political left that comes up with the obvious warning that if you listen to Falwell and Robertson, they are no different from the Ayatollahs. They want a theocracy. This is not what the Founding Fathers had in mind. But let me ask you, just touch on what we were starting to develop a little while ago. It seems to me that what you're talking about in terms of the religious right is not Machiavellianism so much, as you mentioned, but a kind of Manichaeanism, that there's a need for an enemy. Is that a sort of social condition that's inherently American, given the nature of the people who first founded this country? I mean, the fact that they can switch from the communist devil to the homosexual attack on family values in the bat of an eye, it seems to me textbook Manichaeanism. They just need an enemy.
Yeah, I don't know if it's standard American operating policy historically. I would like to think of us as a more generous and more understanding and more sophisticated nation than that. But you sure see it happening now, don't you? That the spirit of fundamentalism, which took over the Iranian embassy and kept hostages for 400 some days, and the spirit of the fundamentalist Jew in Israel recently, who went into the synagogue, into the tomb of Abraham and killed all those believers, or the fundamentalist Muslim who's killing in return and back and forth. You find that same spirit here. They want to purge the nation, to cleanse it. And so they look for an enemy to mobilize their forces, to raise money, to see that we will save this nation from its economic turmoil, from its social disorder, from its end of absolute morality, and we will have something new and wonderful and glorious. And so wherever you see fundamentalism breaking out, whether it's in the Christian world or the other worlds, it's frightening. And the need for an enemy.
Mel White could hardly have been more prescient. The MAGA movement that descended from those fundamentalist groups is also fueled by targeting enemies. White may shed some light on the question, how do evangelical Christians overlook Donald Trump's unchristian behavior? And how convicted Watergate operative Chuck Colson became another link to the right-wing religious coalitions of today.
I was with Falwell discussing with him this need for what he calls co-belligerence. Co-belligerency is a term that they use often now. When Jerry realized he needed to organize the moral majority back in 79, he was afraid that he didn't have enough troops that were real fundamentalist Christians. So Francis Schaeffer, another one of my clients, my first client on the religious right, he said to Jerry, look, in the Old Testament, God used pagans to do his will. Therefore, Jerry, you could use pagans too. You don't have to have Christians. And Jerry said, no, the New Testament says I cannot be unequally yoked together with unbelievers. Oh no, that's not what we're talking about. You don't have to be equally yoked with pagans. Your message will always predominate, and your message is always more important than what they have to do, but you just need to find some enemy you have in common, and then you can use them to do what you want to do in the world. So after communism fell, what would be the issue that would call the co-belligerents together? I mean, last week, Chuck Colson, a fundamentalist of the first order or of the worst order, called a meeting introducing bishops and cardinals of the Catholic Church to Pat Robertson and to the people from the conservative Protestant religious right. They haven't met together since Martin Luther, but they're now meeting around the issue of abortion and homosexuality. It was Hitler's first political action committee, and it worked. Why wouldn't it work for them? And the problem with that is, once you have a co-belligerent issue that holds you all together, you can't then give those people a fair hearing. They can't talk to gay and lesbian people about the reality that we don't have an agenda, that we don't pose a threat to the values of this country, that we're not a threat to the American family, that we don't molest children, that we are in the military serving with dignity and courage. They can't talk about those realities because they need that co-belligerency issue to mobilize everything they're doing.
At heart, this is a question about diversity versus somebody's idea of uniformity.
Jesus, I think, would be really, really incensed if he were here today and would call the Pharisees by their first name. And the old notion of sacrificing a minority for the greater good is what I'm afraid is going to happen to us, and is in fact already happening. They're taking our children away. They're not allowing us to have any rights as couples. Gary and I have been together 10 years. We have no rights. Economically, you should see how we're taxed and double penalized for being together. When you see what they're actually doing now, I think we're being sacrificed already all over this country.
You're listening to excerpts from a 1994 interview with Stranger at the Gate author Mel White, originally conducted by KPFK's Ian Masters. White was there when the giant televangelist empires began. He talks about the influence of conservative Christian media on society, influence that is now being felt in Africa and other parts of the world. The religious right and the political right met again when Jerry Falwell aligned with the infamous Iran-Contragate conspirator Oliver North.
Remember, their billion-dollar media empires, Time magazine showed that Pat's is billion-dollar. I think the larger empire actually is Jan and Paul Crouch, who owns the Trinity Broadcasting Network. They have 440 radio and television stations around the country and the world, with 8 in Italy and 7 in Russia and several in the Ukraine. And I mean, it's unbelievable, the media power. And that media power is to begin to condition people in every country, in every clime, that the fundamentalist political agenda must be saluted and followed in order to save the world from destruction. So behind that is the notion that Jesus will come back when we have created the appropriate climate. And the only way that appropriate climate can be created is to eliminate sin. And sin, gay and lesbian people are we're the current sin that's the worst. And so when for example, Jerry Falwell sees Ollie North going down at the Senate hearings and really suffering, he invites Ollie to Lynchburg and gives him an honorary degree at the lowest moment in Ollie's life. He celebrates it with 10,000 students applauding and cheering. They send Ollie back, and now Ollie has become one of the nation's great, best-known men and best-known heroes to a huge population. I travel with Ollie. I saw the kind of enthusiasm that he evokes everywhere. So now to get Ollie into power is simply an extension of Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson's dreams for Virginia and for the country. So when people vote for Ollie, they're voting for the fundamentalist agenda, which is very unlike what most of them would really agree to. You know, the notion, for example, that they're Jewish friendly because they've gotten more awards for their Zionist. I mean, I can't believe the awards they've gotten from prime ministers of Israel. But in fact, what is their goal? That by the year 2000, some say 2010, Pat Robertson says quite frankly on the year, I want all Jews to be Christians so that we can, you know, that Israel then will be the landing point for Jesus to come back. So that basically, again, it's political. We're transforming, we're cleansing, we're purging, whether by conversion. Remember Clovis, the story in the 4th century? If you didn't get to become a Christian, you lost your head. Well, basically, that's where they're going.
From parade prohibitions to book bans, Mel White was able to predict the agenda of religion-based adversaries.
The media would love for me to say bad things, evil things about Pat Robertson, you know, that he's really in it for the money, that he just wants to be president, all this stuff. No. Pat Robertson loves Jesus and sees himself as the person who should reign until Jesus returns. That's why he calls his university Regent College. A regent is someone in place until the king returns, ruling in place. So I think he's a true believer. I think he's sincere. I think he's sincerely wrong. And Pat Robertson does not want freedom for all people. He wants fundamentalism to triumph. He doesn't want us to have our parades or our authors on the library shelves. If you look at the initiatives that they're trying to pass with his million coalition, Christian coalition group out there, that you can't say anything favorable in a classroom about homosexuality. We're talking about extremism here of the meanest sort. So once we're past the fact that he's affable and loves his wife and children and is sincere, then we have to see him as the demon that he is, given democracy's goals for freedom and understanding and acceptance.
Pat Robertson died in 2023, but his Christian media empire goes on, as does the rival Trinity Broadcasting Network. Mel White's Stranger at the Gate, To Be Gay and Christian in America, is now available as a free audio download at melwhite.org. His most recent book is Storming the Gate, Fighting Religion-Based Oppression with Soul Force.
I met Jesus at the gay pride parade. He was praying for us to be free. A man with a Bible yelled hatefully, and Jesus countered by taking a knee.
This Way Out historic broadcasts from 1988 to 2023 are now preserved and available for research and streaming at the American Archive of Public Broadcasting and at the University of California Santa Barbara Library's Special Collections.
Welcome to the inaugural broadcast of Inside Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine.
The early programs were titled Inside Out until an organization of the same name sent a cease and desist letter.
I'm Greg Gordon.
I'm Lucia Chappell. And during the next half hour, you'll hear reports on the United Kingdom's notoriously homophobic Clause 29.
Almost 200 lesbian and gay activists gather for a war conference in the United States.
In the Magic Kingdom, only heterosexuals can dance cheek to cheek.
And despite violence last September, lesbians and gays in Dubuque prepare for another march. And maybe you can help.
All that and even more now that you're tuning Inside Out.
This Way Out Preservation and Access Project was made possible by grants from UC Santa Barbara Libraries and the American Archive of Public Broadcasting, a collaboration between the Library of Congress and GBH. We thank Keith Brown and Ira Ruffles at Gay Spirit Radio and David Soibert at UC Santa Barbara for the loan of reel-to-reel tapes and cassettes for digitization. Digitization done by George Blood Audio in Philadelphia. I'm Brian DeShazer for This Way Out.
Thanks for discovering This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. News Wrap was reported this week by Michael LeBeau and Tanya Kane Perry and produced by Brian DeShazer. Thanks also to Ian Masters. You heard music by the Moody Blues, Erica Mason, and Ryan Casada. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks John Beaupre of Los Angeles, California, and Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley. Listener donors make this program possible. Ask us about how you can join them. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media. Email us at info@thiswayout.com. www.thewayout.org or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org or wherever you get your podcasts, and on KEUL Girdwood, Alaska, WGGT Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, CJLY Slocum Valley, British Columbia, and a wide array of community terrestrial and internet radio stations around the world, including this one. Stay healthy, stay safe, and stay tuned, y'all.
CFRC 101.9 FM has new social media. Find us on Instagram and Facebook at CFRC Music and keep up with the latest announcements about our programming and projects. Follow us today at CFRC Music.
Hello and welcome to this new edition of Viewpoints. First up this week, good news for Ontario First Nations. The current value of the Ontario First Nations Sovereign Wealth Fund has almost doubled since its creation in 2018. It could be worth $1 billion by 2030.
Since 2018 to currently, it's gone from a total of $321 million to $634 million. It's been a very, very good investment.
BC's Health Minister Adrian Dix announces a massive long-term care facility in Smithers.
We're proud to pay our taxes and put forward and make sure BC is a strong place to live. It's also nice when services come back, when investments come back to our communities, so that these are the livable places that we all dream of.
Also in BC, the city of Nanaimo was recently recognized as a welcoming Francophone community by the federal government.
Even if I was not speaking English, people were like super nice and really calm with me, say, no worries, like, just take your time. People were just like patient, smiley. You have your place. It's a really, really nice place to live in.
And to Nova Scotia, where the Liverpool International Theatre Festival is asking the public to help host visiting actors.
LITF is a celebration of culture and theatre and community, and it's a chance for us, meaning Liverpool, to experience the world.
Welcome to Viewpoint. Local news nationwide.
You are on the air with Viewpoints. Listen to all our stories on frequencynews.ca.
Nice to have you with us again this week. Boris Chassaigne with you. We first turn to BC, where the provincial health minister, Adrian Dix, visited Smithers on Tuesday, August 20th, to announce 160 long-term care beds for the Buckley Valley. A new building will be built on the south end of Broadway Avenue. Construction will begin in 2028, and the facility is slated to open in 2030. And that's music to the ears of many seniors in Smithers. Some are on a four-year waiting list just for one of the 56 beds that currently exist in Smithers' long-term care facilities. This new facility will be built in partnership between Northern Health, the town of Smithers, and Providence Living. Here's Pamela Hassan in Smithers, BC.
One of the things that I believe coming out of the pandemic, and I believe going into the pandemic, is that we had to improve the quality and the amount of long-term care in BC. We have more people in BC, and we have an aging population, but that the quality of that care had to improve. Here in Smithers, of course, there is a profound need for long-term care. You see it in people's homes and the wait times they have to get into long-term care. You see it at the hospital, where people who should be in long-term care are in hospital beds. And today I'm excited to share the news that seniors living in northern BC will have greater access to care closer to home as we prepare to build a new long-term care home in Smithers. The new home in Smithers, which will be located at the south end of Broadway Avenue, will add 60 net new long-term care beds to Smithers and replace 56 beds from Buckley Valley Lodge right here behind me for a total of 216 beds. The project's business plan is now approved. We are proceeding. We expect the construction, and this will begin in 2028, with the facility expected to open for residents in 2030.
The style of housing that will be built in Smithers will be organized as households, accommodating 12 to 13 residents, compared to the 40 or 50 units per household that has been more typical across the province.
The center has the added benefit of social and recreational spaces typical of a home, such as living rooms, dining rooms, activity areas, and access to outdoor spaces where seniors will be able to remain active and build relationships that directly and positively impact their quality of life. There will be other amenities, including art and activity rooms, a hair salon, a sacred space, and many quiet rooms where families can spend time together. This is a community within a community where seniors' well-being and happiness comes first.
This new facility will also offer an adult day program, 32 spaces, which will support older adults living independently at home by providing a social connection, exercise, and health checks for seniors, allowing them to maintain their homes longer while receiving extra support. Again, this new building will increase the number of beds in Smithers from 56 to 216.
Today, there are 1,176 long-term care beds in the entire Northern Health Authority. Prince Rupert, Haida Gwaii, to Fort St. John, and up from Quesnel North. 1,176 we are adding with this, the other projects announced, the other projects we're delivering it, the 200 beds in Prince Shore, so more than 200 beds we're announcing today in Quesnel, beds in Fort St. James, dementia beds in Kitimat, beds in other communities. We are adding 689 beds in the north, reflecting the aging population of the region. This is only possible in a public health care system. It is only possible in the public health care system. This is a 58% increase in beds in this plan that Northern Health is engaging with. While we build a new hospital in Terrace, you know, you're helping pay for it. In Fort St. James, new hospital in Fort St. James, new tower in Prince George, new hospital in Dawson Creek, new ICU and ER in Quesnel. This is a breathtaking, historic investment in healthcare in the North, and the North deserves it. Too many of these projects have been waiting too long, and we are proceeding on all of them.
MLA Nathan Cullen spoke about the investment that the NDP government has made toward access to healthcare services and long-term care in the North.
This is a very large financial commitment from all of us as a province towards this community. And we know as Northerners, we're proud. We're also a little humble sometimes, and we are proud to contribute to the province. We're proud to pay our taxes and put forward and make sure BC is a strong place to live. It's also nice when services come back, when investments come back to our communities, so that these are the livable places that we all dream of. I am appreciative that we are going to have the time to design this facility together.
Next, Scott McCartan, representing Providence Healthcare, a faith-based nonprofit healthcare organization established by Providence Healthcare in 2017, highlighted the collaborative efforts between Providence Healthcare and Northern Health to establish and improve healthcare facilities in the North. The big ticket item was the cost advantage of this partnership, which was that there will be no regional hospital district contribution required for this long-term care facility, freeing up funds for other healthcare infrastructure projects.
It's very exciting. When they move into this new building, the 216 residents in Smithers will encounter a true home. Picturesque, a household layout that mirrors a traditional home, with a kitchen for in-home meal preparation, small intimate dining and living areas, shared by just 12 residents, and really inviting indoor and outdoor community spaces. The new model of care is somewhat enabled by the physical infrastructure, but it's more so delivered through new staffing models, innovative technology, and really a cultural shift in the way that we deliver care that ultimately rests on three foundational principles, and these are core to our beliefs. Number one, we believe that emotional connections matter most. We're not just constructing a building here, we're building a connected community. Number two, that residents direct each moment. Nobody tells any of you when to get up in the morning or when to go to bed, so why would we do that for our residents in their own home? And number three is that home isn't just a place, it's a profound feeling.
Do you have questions or comments? Our email is radio@frequencynews.ca.
I'm Anna Anastasia Avakumova in beautiful British Columbia, and you are tuned to Viewpoints.
So we stay out west as the Association des Francophones de Nanaimo is celebrating the news that Nanaimo has been awarded the title of Welcoming Francophone Community by the federal government. Under Immigration, Refugees and Citizenship Canada, Nanaimo has joined the list of 23 other communities across the country with this new title announced this month. Nanaimo is the second community in British Columbia to receive the title. That's following Prince George in 2018. The recognition comes with additional funds and resources. Journalist Lauren McKenzie spoke with Julie Cloutier, the president of the Francophones of Nanaimo Association, and with Camille Véron, its executive director, who both applied so that Nanaimo would be recognized for this title. Both Cloutier and Véron said that through this initiative, the association will be given resources and funding to welcome all French-speaking newcomers to Nanaimo. Here they are speaking with Lauren McKenzie.
Being a welcoming Francophone community in a place, in an environment where English is really, really strong and represent the majority, it will give something more to Nanaimo compared to the other places around.
And I moved in Nanaimo and I never regret it, because even if I was not speaking English, because my English was zero at that time, 9 years ago, people were like super nice and really calm with me, say like, no worries, like just take your time, because sometimes I didn't understand, or I want to order, or I want to go buy something and I didn't understand the money, but people were just like patient and smiley. So that makes just me feel like, what a nice place to just try. Don't be scared to mix up, because you're so, you have your place and people will welcome you and will be patient.
What is great for a newcomer in Nanaimo, it's that many people, because it's a growing city, many people have been living in different places and they come from different places. Or they were born in Nanaimo, but then they've been studying or living in other places and coming back to Nanaimo because it's a really, really nice place to live in. At the association, we see more and more newcomers coming and we try to help them the more than we can. We also refer them to the specific services they can have, either locally in English or the Francophone one that would be more online. And we also give them like tips and advice as how is it to arrive as a Francophone from another culture here in Nanaimo. And there is some need as well from our partner. For example, the L'École Océane, the Francophone school, needs to have more children coming in to develop and open new section and be more consistent. So they're really with us on that project, and that will benefit for them as well. And also all the services and business in Nanaimo will benefit from a bilingual workforce.
On the air with Viewpoints.
The current value of the Ontario First Nations Sovereign Wealth of Funds portfolio has almost doubled since its creation in 2018. The fund was an agreement that saw 129 Ontario First Nations, including Six Nations, purchase more than 14 million shares of Hydro One. At that time, the Ontario government said the fund was an opportunity to advance economic development for Indigenous communities. First Nations were able to acquire Hydro One shares through a 25-year loan that was financed through the Ontario government for just over $259 million. Ron Jameson, board member for the fund, said that the fund now sits at $634 million, which is almost double its initial value. Jameson says the funds will likely not be distributed to First Nations involved until until 2030. He adds that it's hard to estimate what the fund will be worth by that time, but says it's possible it could be worth $1 billion by then. Details with Andrew Dow in Oshawa, Ontario.
The Ontario First Nations Sovereign Wealth Fund has almost doubled its portfolio's wealth over the last 6 years. The fund, which was created in 2018, was an agreement that saw the Ontario First Nations Power Holdings Limited Partnership purchase more than 14 million shares of Hydro One. The limited partnership is owned by 129 Ontario First Nations, including Six Nations of the Grand River. Those First Nations were able to acquire the Hydro One shares through a 25-year loan that was financed through the Government of Ontario. The loan amounted to just over $259 million and saw shares purchased at $18 per share. Additionally, another $29 million was also set aside in seed capital for the investment fund to pay board members and other administrative costs. The Ontario Ministry of Energy spoke on the creation of the fund in a 2016 media release that read, quote, "This agreement in principle demonstrates the goodwill envisioned by the political accord to promote stronger economic relations and is one of the many steps on Ontario's journey of healing and reconciliation with Indigenous peoples. If ratified, this new agreement will provide meaningful opportunities to First Nations for collective wealth creation and to advance economic development initiatives," end quote. Ron Jameson, a board member for Ontario First Nations Sovereign Wealth Fund Limited Partnership, updated Six Nations Elected Council on the fund's growth during the August 19th General Council meeting. Jameson detailed what Hydro One shares are currently selling for compared to what the shares were purchased for in 2018.
So the Hydro One shares have performed very well from, well, it says 2017, but 2018 to 2022, creating significant wealth for the First Nations. In fact, as of this morning, the value of a one share of Hydro One is $44. And remember that we had the opportunity to buy it at 18.
He also spoke on the overall growth the fund has seen since its creation.
So if you look at the investment performance, you can see what's happened from 2018 till currently. And, you know, that doesn't even reflect that the Hydro One shares are $44 now, because this slide is a couple months old, but, you know, it's pretty current. But you can see that since 2018 to currently, it's gone from a total of $321 million to $634 million. And so that is stellar return.
Jameson says the Sovereign Wealth Fund's board have gradually begun to sell some of the shares and reinvest those profits back into other funds to protect the Sovereign Wealth Fund and its profits.
We're going to continue on that track of, on a gradual basis, liquidating some Hydro One shares into a broader investment portfolio. That's very good for the Sovereign Wealth Fund because you're not betting on one particular stock at any time. Now, we still have a lot of Hydro One shares remaining, and we just want to do it judiciously, meaning to have the best timing we can to sell shares in the market and convert it into other opportunities.
Jameson says that Ontario First Nations have not begun to pay off the initial loan with the Government of Ontario, and he explained why that is and how it benefits the First Nations involved with the fund.
We have not paid any principal on the Hydro One loan that the Government of Ontario granted to us. There's a good reason for that, because the money is so cheap. You don't want to start paying it back with money you're making, because you can reinvest it, but it's just so cheap to use Ontario's money that it's just perfect. So at some date in the future, we will pay off. Like, if we paid off our loan right now, we would be, instead of having $634 million in overall, we would have $250 million approximately less than that number. We see no advantage in repaying the Ontario government. And they agree. We met with them a few times because they kind of had to bless our strategy. They want to make sure they have collateral on their loan. So we've met with them a few times, and they agree that our strategy is the right one. Even though Hydro One is a great investment opportunity, it's not the only one.
He also explained that 2030 is likely when First Nations will see revenues from this fund be distributed back to the Ontario First Nations communities.
We cannot distribute until the initial seed capital, which was $29 million, reaches a value of $90 million or 12 years, whichever comes first. 12 years would make it 2030. So we've got a number of years here yet before we consider distributing the profits to First Nation communities. And right now, if you distributed it, it sounds like a lot of money, but if you cut it over 129 partners, it really isn't. It's not anything like, for example, the OFNLP from the gaming revenue, which is substantially more, okay, over that number of communities. So we feel that we're going to keep doing our job and hopefully get it up to a point where it'd be very easy for us to repay Ontario and make a distribution to First Nation communities. But as I say, we're a number of years or dollars from that point.
Jameson spoke on what the fund's total revenue could look like when it's time to distribute money back to those Ontario First Nations involved.
You know, I know that it's gone from 230 odd million to over 624 million.
It could grow up to a billion.
Absolutely, it could. In fact, that's my personal belief that when we get to 2030, it will be a billion. That's a lot of money, but it's still going to get divided up in some basis of formula. So, but it's been a very, very good investment. And as I say, we have the best advisors, the best legal counsel, etc., to guide us.
Six Nations elected council accepted the update from Ron Jameson as information and also approved for him to return to council annually to provide updates on the fund. I'm Andrew Dow, and this news story is brought to you by the Local Journalism Initiative, which supports the creation of original civic journalism.
Candace Vetter in Embrun, Ontario, and you're tuned into Viewpoints. Follow us on X at Frequency News. Listen to all our stories on frequencynews.ca.
And our final stop will be in the Maritimes, where one of the only international theater festivals in Atlantic Canada, the Liverpool International Theater Festival, just put out an urgent call. It's asking for residents, local residents, to help provide accommodations for some 90 actors and crew members expected to arrive in Liverpool, Nova Scotia in October. This year, troops from Morocco, Egypt, Italy, Switzerland, Wales, and the U.S. will be putting on one-act plays between October 17 and the 20th in an event that celebrates the theater and international friendship. The local theater group Winds of Change from Liverpool will also be putting on a play at the festival. Here's Rick Conrad in Liverpool, Nova Scotia.
It happens every 2 years. It's less than 2 months away, and the organizers of the Liverpool International Theatre Festival want you to be part of it. The festival is looking for local residents to open their homes and help welcome the almost 90 people coming to Liverpool from 10 different countries for the four-day event. The volunteer-driven festival is celebrating its 16th edition from October 17th to 20th at the Astor Theatre. This year, amateur theatre troops from Morocco, Egypt, the country of Georgia, Mexico, Italy, Switzerland, Wales, and the U.S. will be putting on one-act plays in an event that celebrates theater and international friendship. Winds of Change Theater Group from Liverpool will also be putting on a play at the festival. Jean Robinson is the festival's chairwoman.
They are one-act plays,
And they have to be between 25 minutes long and 50 or 55 minutes long. And so it's a great introduction to theater and different types of theater for folks that may have an interest in that.
Deborah Rattle is in charge of LITF's marketing and promotions.
LITF is a celebration of culture and theater and community, and it's a chance for us, meaning Liverpool, to experience the world.
The festival relies on 40 to 60 volunteers from the community to make it happen. Members of the troops are billeted at homes around Queens County. This year, organizers are putting an urgent call out for people to open their homes to the actors and crews coming to Liverpool. LITF asks hosts to provide a bed and some breakfast for festival participants. The festival looks after everything else, including other meals and transportation. Hosts also get two free tickets to the play involving their guests. Radall and her husband Blair have hosted troops in their home for many previous festivals.
It's a wonderful experience. My experience, Blair and I's experience, has been really great with that. We've hosted pretty much every year we've hosted and have made wonderful friendships and connections. And it is quite unique for a theater festival. It's a bed and breakfast situation. What we ask of our hosts, at a minimum, is to provide a bed, provide breakfast for them in the mornings, and to pick them up when they arrive, if it's a reasonable time. If it's a later time, then the drivers will take them to your home. So that's really basically all we ask. At a minimum interaction is to make them welcome in your home, give them something to eat in the mornings, and our festival is designed to pick up all the rest of the stuff. You're not obligated to entertain. You're not obligated to do anything more, really, than provide them a bed and breakfast.
Robinson said hosts and guests have made lasting connections.
Hosts can be as engaged in the festival as they want to be. We know that troops have, as we've said before, these have become lifelong friendships and also new experiences. People have gotten to go skating for the first time with their host, or even being taken to the ocean to see
the beach for the first time.
Being on a boat, going out on a lobster boat or things like that, that have just kind of cemented those relationships.
Rattle says they're still looking for space for about 40 troop members. Troops and potential hosts fill out questionnaires so that organizers can help make sure the experience is as positive as possible for everybody.
It's a process that's not just, we're just going to check somebody on your doorstep without having a conversation about what works best for you and what works best for them.
If you're interested in becoming a host for the Liverpool International Theatre Festival, you can contact info@LITF.ca, check out their website at LITF.ca, or message them at their Facebook page. I'm Rick Conrad.
And so that's it for us. Thanks to our journalists, Rick Conrad, Pamela Hassan, Andrew Dow, Lauren McKenzie. To our national editors, Victoria Fenner and Maureen McEwen. Viewpoints is brought to you by the Community Radio Fund of Canada and the Local Journalism Initiative. Boris Chassaigne, your host and producer, thanks for having us again this week. And until the next, goodbye. We'll be right back.
or comments? Our email is radio@frequencynews.ca. Radio@frequencynews.ca.